speaker, was born in a suburb of New York City of Jewish parents who had fled Nazi Germany. His Jewish education and formation was received under some of the most prominent rabbis in contemporary American Jewry, including Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach, a prominent Hasidic rabbi with whom he lived in Israel for several months. His secular education included a Bachelor of Science from MIT in Boston and an MBA magna cum laude from Harvard Business School. Midway through a career of teaching and consulting, he had been appointed to the faculty of the Harvard Business School. He experienced an unexpected and instantaneous conversion to Christianity, which led him to a dramatic refocus of his activities. Pursuing theological studies at several seminaries and becoming active in Catholic evangelization through books, television, and radio. In 2003, his first book, Salvation is from the Jews, was published by Ignatius Press, becoming a surprise bestseller, and shortly followed thereafter by Honey from the Rock. He has become a popular guest on EWTN, appearing on shows including The Journey Home, EWTN Live, Bookmark, and Women of Grace. He teaches on the faculties of Ave Maria University in Florida and Holy Apostles Seminary. Please, everyone, please give a warm welcome to Roy Schumann.
Hi. I'm very grateful for that introduction, and I'm very grateful to all of you for being here, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I'm actually speaking twice this weekend, so today my plan is to primarily give my witness testimony, and then tomorrow morning also, I'll talk more about the role of Judaism in salvation history from a Catholic perspective, and the way that the Catholic Church is essentially the continuation of Judaism after the coming of the Jewish Messiah. I didn't plan on starting here, but I guess I'll start here. Because in fact, it's all of one story, right? It's one story that began in the Garden of Eden and will end with the Second Coming. It's a story of salvation history, and the first phase of that story preparing for the incarnation of God as man was Judaism. And when that incarnation took place, the relationship between God and man was transformed, and it went from the first phase to the second phase, which was the Catholic Church, which is spreading the redemption which came with the coming of the Jewish Messiah to all of mankind through Christianity and through the sacraments of the Catholic Church. So that's actually not what I'm talking about today, despite appearances. That's what I'll be talking about more tomorrow. But let me just start today with my witness testimony, and maybe if I have time near the end of it, I'll get more into the theology. So, as Maddie mentioned, my parents were German Jewish Holocaust refugees. They both were born and raised in Germany. My father left Germany very early after Hitler came to power. There was a short period when the Jews were actually being encouraged to leave as long as they left everything behind, and he got out then. My mother's family was less fortunate. They fled to France, but France soon fell under the Nazis. And my mother was actually arrested by the Gestapo in France and put on a train to a concentration camp. But she escaped while the train was still in France and eventually made it to the United States, where my parents met and married. I grew up in a suburb of New York, very Jewish. My parents, of course, were Jewish. I was Jewish. Our whole world was Jewish. There was less mixing in those days. In fact, the town where my parents lived was the only town in northern Jersey which actually allowed Jews to buy houses there. That's how separate the communities were in those days. And I had a devout Jewish upbringing. I went to Jewish religious education all the way from the beginning of my school years in first grade until the end of high school, until college. And in fact, late in my high school years, I became even more kind of fanatically devout or whatever, and became the disciple of a Hasidic rabbi that Maddie mentioned, Shlomo Carlebach. The Hasids, you may know them from, you know, Fiddler on the Roof or Yentl or something, but they're the ultra-Orthodox Jews with the long ear curls and the black gabardine coats and fur hats. And I became the disciple of this Hasidic rabbi and actually lived with him and traveled with him in Israel the summer between high school and college, entertaining the possibility of not going back at the end of the summer for university, but instead staying in Israel and essentially entering Jewish religious life, the closest thing that Judaism has to religious life, which is basically a yeshiva. That's a little bit of a digression, but a life dedicated to religious study and prayer. But I didn't. I went back to the U.S. I began MIT that fall. I lost my faith at university, as do, unfortunately, many, many kids. And I lost it due to two reasons. I'm obviously referring to my Jewish faith. One was the pseudoscientific worldview that religion is just a kind of medieval superstition and science has all the answers, and anything that science doesn't have the answer to today, it will in 5 years. And, you know, religion was just something people believed in, you know, before they discovered science. But that's not actually a scientific worldview. It's the opposite of scientific worldview. That's why I called it a pseudoscientific worldview, because the essence of science is that you start with the evidence, you start with the data, and you formulate a theory that can explain the data. And if it is unable to explain the data, you have to throw out that theory and come up with another theory to explain the data. In fact, all of the data, all of the evidence is in favor of the Catholic faith. The scientific, in quotes, worldview that reduces everything to materialism is the opposite of scientific because it fails miserably to explain the data. All you have to do is think of, for instance, the medical miracles at Lourdes, for that matter, all of the miracles associated with the life of Padre Pio, the Shroud of Turin. There's a beautiful exhibit of the Shroud of Turin back there in the exhibition hall. But even today, in all of modern science, with all of the tools available to modern science, they could not fake a Shroud of Turin today. You know, and it dates back, it actually dates back to the days of Jesus, but at least its history is proven to the medieval days. There's tons of physical scientific evidence that can't be explained with materialism. So in fact, this view that you have to choose between science and faith is absolutely the opposite of the truth. The truth is that if you have a scientific view, you really have to come to grips with all of the evidence for the Catholic faith, and there really is no way to explain it other than the apparent explanation, which is that it's all true. Anyway, that's all a digression, but a very perhaps valuable digression. But anyway, I didn't know all of that, of course, in university, and I bought the party line, and I came out of there an atheist, and I went on to Harvard Business School, and I did well enough there to be invited back to join the faculty. So I found myself a newly minted professor of marketing at Harvard Business School at the ripe old age of 29, and that's really where my witness testimony begins. Because what had been going on was that all of my life, since I was a small child, I felt there has to be a real meaning and purpose to life, and I'll come in to know that real meaning and purpose to life when I'm older. And as a child, I thought that the meaning and purpose of life would come from entering into a personal relationship with God, which I honestly thought would happen at my bar mitzvah. The bar mitzvah is like the Catholic confirmation. When the boy is 13, there's a ceremony in the synagogue where he reads from the Torah for the first time and he enters into religious adulthood. And I honestly thought that on my bar mitzvah, the veil would drop and I would come to know God personally. And when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days of my childhood. But then pretty soon I decided the real meaning and purpose of life would come when I got a driver's license, or when I got a girlfriend, or when I left home for college, or when I began my career and so forth. But here I was already far more successful in secular terms than I ever expected to be, being a professor at Harvard Business School. But life still had no meaning or purpose. The difference being, at this point, there was nothing more I could look forward to that I could imagine might give life meaning and purpose, because I had already kind of, you know, won the brass ring of worldly success. So it was actually at that point I fell into the deepest despair of my life, a kind of existential despair. And it was, in those days, the only relief I found was walking in beautiful places in nature. So early one morning, I was walking in the low pine woods behind the beach on Cape Cod, when I received the most spectacular single grace of my life. I had long since given up any hope in believing in God, but from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven disappeared, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life and understanding my life as though I had died and was looking back over my life after death in the presence of God. And I saw how I would feel about everything after I died. I understood everything the way I will understand it after I died. I saw that my two greatest regrets after I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love, greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be all of every hour that I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that it was all true, that we live forever, that everything we do has a moral content that is recorded and observed and weighed in the balance, and recorded for all eternity, that every moment has the potential for moral action, that if we take advantage of it and do the right thing, we will be rewarded for all eternity in heaven. And if we don't take advantage of that opportunity, it will be, in some sense, a lost opportunity, a wasted opportunity for which we will be kicking ourselves for all eternity in heaven. Now, let me make, by way of apology, I was a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School at the time, so everything was cost-benefit analysis, net present value, maximizing returns, and so forth. And I was still sort of seeing this in through that lens. So the way I saw it at the time was that the problem wasn't that I had been entirely selfish all my life, it was that I had been stupid and selfish and had been working for things which wouldn't matter at all to me 100 years from now after I'm dead, instead of working for things from which I would very literally be benefiting 100 million years from now if I took advantage of the opportunity. And I saw, it was as though I was spending all of my energy in my life accumulating Monopoly money, you know, that brightly papered, you know, money in Monopoly, when there was a pile of gold coins next to it that I could have been accumulating instead, which would be working for riches in heaven. I saw how foolish I had been, living my life sort of in the rearview mirror, saying to myself, if only that hadn't happened, then I would be happy today, or if only that hadn't happened, then I would be happy today, when nothing could be further from the truth, that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged coming from the hands of an all-knowing, all-loving God, not only including those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering at the time that I had thought of as the greatest disasters. The single most overwhelming aspect of this experience was coming into this intimate awareness that God had been watching over me, controlling everything that happened to me, caring about me, not only hearing every prayer I ever said, but actually aware of every thought I had, uniting his heart to mine every moment since my conception, as though I were the whole purpose of creation, as though I were the only human being he had ever created, as though I were the only creature he had ever created. That it's like his ears were to my lips, just waiting for the slightest murmur of my heart, and that everything that had made me happy, you know, he rejoiced at, and everything that had made me sad had kind of made him sad. And it was coming into that awareness of just how intimately God knew me and cared about me, which I had not had even as a devout Jew growing up. So I knew, of course, that the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God who was revealing himself to me. But what I didn't know was what his name was and what religion to follow. I couldn't put this together with Judaism and the God of the Old Testament. Now I know that, of course, it was the God of the Old Testament. But in all honesty, if you read the Old Testament, The picture of God that emerges is of a God far more distant and judgmental and severe than this God was. And in fact, the God in the Old Testament does not speak to the people. He speaks through the prophets and the priests and the patriarchs, but he does not speak to the hoi polloi. And a picture of this is in Exodus, when Moses is about to go up on Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments. God tells him, build a fence around the base of the mountain to prevent any of the people from approaching the base of the mountain while I'm on top. Because if they do approach and touch the base of the mountain while I'm on top, they have to be immediately killed for the sacrilege. So that is the picture that I had of the God of the Old Testament, the God of Judaism. So I prayed on the spot. Hold on a moment, I'm going to untie this microphone so I can be a little less tethered. So I prayed on the spot. I was still walking while this happened, by the way. And I'll make a little digression. It's when the veil dropped and I was looking into heaven, I wasn't surprised that I was seeing heaven. And I still actually saw the physical world. That's how I could keep walking. But it's like the physical world was just this gossamer, you know, very pale screen with the real world behind it, which is the spiritual world. And I wasn't surprised that I was seeing into the spiritual world. The only thing I was surprised at was that I could ever have not seen it. It was so much more real and so much more physical and more immediate than the physical world that I could not understand how I could ever have been blind to it. And I could not understand, it never occurred to me that I could ever lose the vision of the spiritual world. It was inconceivable to me. It was like, how could I ever have not seen it? And I couldn't imagine ever not seeing it again. It was as though, I don't know if you've ever been at sometimes it's a play, sometimes it's a ballet or something, but before the show begins, the curtain is drawn, the house lights are on, you just see the front of the curtain. Then before the show starts, the lights go down, there are lights on the front of the curtain, so you still just see the curtain. But then they dim those lights in front of the curtain, and they turn up the stage lights behind the curtain, and all of a sudden the curtain disappears, and you see through the curtain to what's going on stage. And that's what this was like, and I could see the physical world as this like translucent curtain veiling the real world, but the real world is really what was real. So anyway, that was a digression again. But so I'm still walking along, and I pray, let me know your name, so I know what religion to follow to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Christian and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. And I very literally prayed this, and this came from being Jewish, and I suspect that many of you know Jews and can kind of understand this. It was made worse by the fact that my parents were Holocaust refugees, and I had been raised with a sense that Christianity is the enemy, that Christianity is out to get the Jews, that all of the suffering of the Jews for the last 2,000 years is because of this, you know, heretical sect of Christianity and so forth. So I actually prayed this, let me know your name as long as you're not Christ, and he respected that prayer and he didn't tell me his name. Let me see if there are any other things about this experience before I leave it that I want to mention. Maybe not. I will say one thing. It's going to sound very flaky, but it's the truth, and of course you're free, more than free, not to believe me. But I actually saw two other things in this experience. I saw the angelic hierarchy, and it was sort of like an upside down funnel, and it was like there were a lot of lesser angels near the bottom, and then the hierarchies went higher and higher and got narrower and narrower and fewer and more glorious until they disappeared into the Godhead. And the other thing that I saw, which is really weird, is I saw the nature around me because I was walking and I was still seeing the physical world. And I saw, it was actually kind of beautiful. I saw how all of nature was worshiping God. Actually, the only aspect of nature that doesn't worship God is us, right, is man in our rebellion. I saw how all the insects in their way were giving praise and glory to God by their cooperating with nature, you know, all of the plants and the flowers, you know, raising up themselves to the sun, which was kind of like a picture of the divine goodness and so forth. And this, you know, beautiful, harmonious, you know, kind of harmony and worshipful adoration of God, unknowingly, of course, you know, through all of creation, all of nature, you know, except for us in our fallen state. So I think I'll leave that experience right now, but I will actually leave some time at the end of my talking for questions if somebody wants to, you know, to ask something about that. But anyway, this state of consciousness faded very slowly, and it actually faded when I came across other people, was when it started to fade. And with each other person that I kind of came in contact with, I dropped another notch until about 3 or 4 hours later, I was more or less in ordinary consciousness. I went back home to Cambridge, where I lived in those days, happy for the first time since childhood. I knew it was all true. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was never any reason to be anxious or worried about anything, that, you know, a God who loved us far more than we loved ourselves was controlling absolutely everything that happened. I knew that we had nothing better to look forward to than death. I mean, in other words, you know, that I mean, the day we die, if we do things right, is going to be the happiest day of our lives. I mean, you know, that there's absolutely nothing to worry about. They say that the two certain things in life are death and taxes, right? And the fact that death is certain is actually the greatest possible consolation, because death is absolutely certain, which means that our eternal reward is absolutely certain. And if we do things right, that eternal reward is greater than we ever could imagine in our wildest dreams. So I was happy for the first time since childhood. All I wanted to do was learn more about this God who had revealed himself to me, learn who he was, what religion to follow him, to worship him properly, and so forth. I quickly lost interest in teaching Harvard MBAs how to make a little bit more money. And so I kind of, it was actually about 4 or 5 years, but I drifted away from my career at Harvard Business School. I just wanted to pursue this experience. What I did was, let me see how I'm doing for time. So every night before going to sleep, well, I'll spend a little more time on this. I did two things. I did a smart thing and a stupid thing. The stupid thing was I had just had a mystical experience, and I wanted to find out more about this mystical experience. So what do you do if you want to find out more about a mystical experience? You find a mystic to talk to, which wasn't a very prudent thing to do in a college town in the 1980s. In fact, it's never a very prudent thing to do. So I found this self-styled mystic Kabbalist and went over to his house hoping he could shed some light on this experience. And he just pointed me in all kinds of terrible directions, you know, Hindu gurus and stuff like that. He was a fallen away Catholic. But one good thing happened when I went over to see him, which was at one point in the evening, he went in the kitchen to make us some tea. And I was left alone in the living room. And on his coffee table, he had this big, like, coffee table picture book called something like the 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times. And so while I'm waiting for him to come back from the kitchen, I'm leafing through this book, and my eyes fall on a page dedicated to the miracle at Fatima. Now, all of you have heard of the miracle of Fatima, right? I had probably spent 22 years in school. I had never heard of the miracle of Fatima. No one had ever told me about Fatima. I'm reading about the sun dancing in the sky and crashing to the earth and so forth. And so this friend comes out from the kitchen. His name was Bob. Bob comes back from the kitchen with a tea, and I point to that page, and I say, is this true? Did this really happen? And he says, oh, yes. And my next question is, has anyone else ever heard of it? Because I had never heard of it, right? And he said, oh, sure, you know, all Catholics know about it. So then I say, has anything else been written about it? And he says, oh, yeah, just go to the public library. You'll find a dozen books on Fatima. My initial response was furious indignation. How could they have kept this secret from me all my life? All my life in my Jewish religious education, I was asking the teachers, how come God used to perform miracles in the days of the Old Testament and stopped doing miracles? And they never had an answer for me. I felt my whole life would have been different had I known that miracles still occur. Okay? Now, I had a lot of Catholics that crossed my path in those 29 years until this experience. We live in this pseudoscientific age. Everyone wants proof, everyone wants evidence, and so forth, right? God has given us more physical evidence of the truths of the faith in our day than I think he's ever given before, right? So the Shroud of Turin is a good example. I have a book that was written by Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientists, who, not Catholics, who examined the Shroud of Turin and found all of these miraculous things about it. You have the miracles of Fatima, you have the medical miracles at Lourdes. Don't keep it secret, because if you want to evangelize, you know, in our day, using these miracles are a very good way to evangelize. Anyway, so I was just, you know, filled with this furious indignation. I left there with all kinds of unhealthy, new agey books, but with the miracle of Fatima in the back of my mind. And then the smart thing I did after that first experience was every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer I had made up to know the name of my Lord and God and Master who had revealed himself that day to me on the beach. So a year after that first experience, and I know it was exactly a year to the day, because I remember before going to sleep praying a prayer of thanksgiving for that earlier experience, I went to sleep, and I thought I was woken by a hand gently on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. Now, I know now that this was a kind of out-of-body experience. My body was still asleep in bed. If there had been a camera in the room, it would have shown me asleep in bed. But I thought I was awake while it was happening. My memory represents it as though I were awake. The feeling, you know, the quality of the experience was of a waking experience. So I can only describe it as I experienced it. So I felt like I was woken by a hand on my shoulder and led to a room and left alone with, as I said, the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. Just to be in her presence and to feel the purity and the intensity of the love that flowed from her was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I ever could imagine could exist. When I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately. I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Her first words to me were that she would answer any questions I might have for her. The first thought that crossed my mind when I found myself in her presence was, oh my goodness, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary so I could honor her somehow. So when she offered to answer any questions I might have for her, I kind of wanted to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary, but I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it. So instead, as a kind of backdoor way of learning it, I asked her what her favorite prayer to her was. Well, her answer was a little bit coy. It was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little bit pushy. Maybe that's because I'm a New York Jew and maybe not. But I said, but you must love some prayers to you more than others. And she relented and she recited a prayer, but it was in Portuguese and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember it phonetically. And the next morning when I woke up, I immediately wrote down the first few syllables phonetically. And then later when I met a Catholic Portuguese woman, I asked her to recite all of the Marian prayers in Portuguese so I could identify it. And to the best of my ability, the prayer was, O Mary conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee. I asked her about four or five other questions. I'll say two things before I mention a couple of those questions. One was, as beautiful as she was to look at, even more powerfully moving was the beauty of her voice. Her voice was like pure love and pure music just passing through you and lifting your soul into ecstasy. I asked her a few more questions. One question I asked her, this whole experience was permeated with just a sense of awe of her presence and how glorious and magnificent she was and how humbling this experience was to be in her presence. And so most of my questions just came out of that response to her. So I remember asking her, it was more of an exclamation than a question, but I just kind of stammered out, how is it possible? How can it be? How is it possible that you're so glorious, that you're so exalted, that you're so magnificent? How can it be? And she just looked down at me sort of pityingly and shook her head gently. And she said, oh no, you don't understand. You don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature, I'm a created thing, he's everything. And then I'll mention at least one other, or maybe I'll mention two other questions and answers. By now I had figured out that it had been Christ on the beach, and this is all about Christianity, and I had better get up to speed pretty quick. And all my life I had heard the expression, the Holy Spirit, but I had no idea what it meant. I didn't even know that it was a person. So I apologize for the way I phrased this question, but I asked her, I said, and I do apologize for the phrasing, but I said, what's this business about the Holy Spirit? And her response was just to look upwards with an expression melting with love and say, he's his gaze. Gaze, G-A-Z-E. Later, when I mentioned this experience to some seminarian friends of mine, they pointed out that St. Thomas Aquinas had called the Holy Spirit the look of love that passes between the Father and the Son. The last question and answer I think I'll mention is, again, out of a desire to honor her appropriately, I asked what title she liked best for herself. And she said, I am the beloved daughter of the Father, mother of the Son, and spouse of the Spirit. So anyway, after the questions and answers, when that part was over, she said she had something else she wanted to talk to me about, and she spoke to me for about another 12 or 15 minutes. And then the audience was over. I went back to sleep. The next morning, when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ in that first experience. I knew that I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely a Christian as possible. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic was. But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and I was hopelessly in love with her. And that led me fairly directly to the Catholic Church. At the time, let me mention two things. One was when I woke up the next morning, my first thought was, oh good, I can't wait to go to sleep again tonight and see her again. It never occurred to me that it wouldn't happen, you know? And then when I didn't see her again that night, I was very disappointed the next morning, but I said, oh, it's sure to happen at least once a week. And then when it didn't happen, I said to myself, at least once a month, you know? And at least annually, right? And by the time I realized that it would never happen again, the memory had faded to the point where I could face life without it happening again. But if someone had told me the next morning when I woke up, this will never happen again, and you're going to have to go through another 60 or 70 years on earth and never see her again, I really don't know how I could have faced life. So the next morning when I got up, there really wasn't anything I could do other than open a local phone book and find a church to go to, which was a Protestant church. But when I got to know the pastor a little bit, and I kind of shyly asked, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And he answered with less respect than I knew was due her. I just knew this was no place for me. And then the other thing which was happening in those days was I was spending all my time hanging out at Marian shrines just to kind of walk the grounds and feel her presence and kind of commune with her. And there was not far from my house a shrine to Our Lady of La Salette. I'm very gratified, by the way, to have found out that there are a couple of La Salette missionary fathers here on this conference this weekend. This was the shrine to Our Lady of La Salette in Ipswich, Massachusetts. And I would go up there three or four times a week just to hang out and walk the grounds and so forth. And of course, Marian shrines are all held by the Catholic Church. So then that winter, I went to the Alps skiing, which is another story, and it was rained out. The skiing was rained out. It was raining, and the skiing wasn't very good. So I thought, I will visit the real La Salette. I was still anti-Catholic in these days. I wasn't really anti-Christian, but I was certainly still anti-Catholic. I was kind of anti-Christian. It's kind of, doesn't make any sense, but don't look to it to make any sense. But, you know, there was so much emotional baggage there that even though I was pro-Christ and pro-Mary, I still couldn't quite swallow the idea that this meant being Christian. God forbid, much less being Catholic. But I went to the original site of Our Lady of La Salette. It was a Marian apparition, church approved, of course, 1846, high in the French Alps, a one-time apparition to two shepherd children. The Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to them. This is, by the way, the site is far above tree line. It's at about 12,000 feet, just just, you know, soaring cliffs and snowfields and little hollows. You've left the nearest village behind, you know, 5-10 miles away, you know, wound up the mountain on these switchback roads, you know, just glaciers and granite cliffs and stuff. You look down into a little hollow, and there's this beautiful basilica built on the side of the apparition. Nothing else there. I went up there. I thought I'd just go up there for the afternoon and come back, but it took all day to get there. And so I'll just, I don't know even why I'm going down this road, but a lot of my conversion took place during that stay at La Salette that winter. And I'll just shortchange it a little bit, but I thought I'd go there for the afternoon. I was stuck there for the whole trip, for the rest of the ski trip, because a blizzard came in. The rain that was where I was skiing was snow there. The road down was closed. I was stuck there for the remaining about 10 days of my ski trip. While I was there, I couldn't stay awake for more than 2 or 3 hours a day. I was just forced into all of these continual healing naps, very strong sense of the presence of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a lot of dreams of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a lot of healing which took place there. And then finally, when the road was open, there was just time for me to go back to Geneva to catch my flight home. The night before catching the plane back to the United States, I'm sleeping on a friend's couch in Geneva. And before going to sleep, I say a prayer. It's really whining complaint to God. And I say to him, I can't believe you did this to me. I go halfway around the world to go skiing. It would have been the best ski conditions of my life, right? Because it was a blizzard, right? It was 3 feet of fresh snow powder falling every day. And you don't let me go skiing. Instead, you stick me at La Salette. I can't believe you did that to me. So I go to sleep in that mood. And I wake into a dream, another very awake-feeling dream, and I'm confronted with this man, very serious, very somber, but you still knew he was full of love. He reminded me of like that, you know, high school science teacher who was very stern, but all the kids knew he really loved them, you know, more than the other kind of happy, clappy teachers did. And I'm confronted with him, and he just drills me with his eyes, and he says, "You can go skiing, or you can work for the Second Coming. It's your choice. Which do you choose?" So anyway, I got the message, and I went back to the United States, and that's really the story of how I found myself in the Catholic Church. It still took me a little time to figure out the Catholic Church was the truth, but knowing who the Blessed Virgin Mary was made it pretty direct. I will tell another story. The reason for it will be obvious. So when I was at La Salette stuck there, I was talking to other pilgrims there, and one of them was a French woman. She called me after I got back to the United States and said, it occurs to me it would be a good idea if you checked out the Carthusians. Do any of you know the Carthusians? Have heard of the Carthusians? If you know that movie, Integrate Silence, that took place at a Carthusian monastery, the Carthusians are the strictest contemplative order in the church. They live by the same rule that they developed in the 12th century. They live in strict silence. They live in solitary confinement. The monks, each in their own cell, they never talk to each other except once a week in recreation. They eat alone, one meal a day. In order to keep from even seeing the monk who brings you the food, it's like deposited in like this dumb waiter, and you know the monk closes the door, and then you get it from the inside. Very strict contemplative order. And when I heard about them, I thought, oh yeah, this makes sense. I should get in touch with them. Because they better be mystics. If they're not mystics, they go nuts, you know, with such a penitential, boring life, right? Just living in solitary confinement. So she had given me the phone number of this monastery in France. So I called them up. It never occurred to me that they're not going to answer the phone because they don't talk, right? But somebody answers the phone. It turns out to be the prior, which is how he could answer the phone. And I say, could I come and visit? And he says, oh, no, absolutely not. We're strictly cloistered. You know, we don't receive people. But then he says, tell me something about yourself. So I start telling him a little bit about myself, my experiences, and he relents, and I can hear in his voice, he's starting to waver. So I say, should I send you a letter? And he said, good idea, write me a letter. So I wrote him a letter, and he immediately wrote back, you're welcome anytime. What I didn't know was there one exception to not receiving anybody is if they think it's a potential vocation. So I find myself at this Carthusian monastery in the south of France, still Jewish, still very anti-Catholic, you know, with these monks in their strictly penitential life. I'm just on a visit, right? But I'm you know, kind of joining them a little bit in their life. So all these things happen on that trip. One is they break sleep every night. They never sleep for about more than 3 hours. They go to sleep at about 8:30, they get up at about 11:30, they go to the chapel and they chant psalms for 2 or 3 hours, and then they go back to sleep again from like 2 to 5 before getting up for morning prayers. So I'm joining them in their chapel chanting psalms, you know, at midnight, and they're all of these elderly monks, you know, in the choir stalls, you know, chanting for hours, "Oh Jerusalem, should I ever forget you? Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. And oh Zion, you know, there is no beauty as great as yours," and so forth. And I'm looking around at them and I'm saying to myself, these guys are all wannabe Jews. And then one day I'm working in the fields, actually cutting grass with a scythe, you know, from the 16th century. And one of the elderly monks shuffles out to me because, of course, they couldn't talk, so some of them like to take the opportunity to, you know, get away with talking when they could. So he shuffled out to me in the fields, and he says very shyly, "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" And I say, "No." And he says, "Well, some of us noticed you're not Catholic, are you?" That's because I wasn't receiving communion, you know, at Mass. And I said, "No, that's true, I'm not Catholic." And he says, "Well, if you don't mind us asking, what are you then?" And I say, "I'm Jewish." And he goes, "Oh, that's a relief. We were all afraid you were Protestant." Because, of course, to them, the Protestants had the faith and turned their back on it, and the Jews were just, you know, they're the people to whom they owed the faith who hadn't come into the fullness of it yet. So that stay really turned around my feelings about the Catholic Church, because I saw that in some fundamental sense, true Catholics are wannabe Jews, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow, and that that if you're filled with a true Catholic sensibility, you have to have a deep appreciation and gratitude to Jews and Judaism, if for nothing else, for having brought you Jesus, for having brought you the church, for having brought you the Catholic faith, right? Because Jesus was Jewish, you know, the Blessed Virgin Mary was Jewish, all of the apostles were Jewish, the church was spread throughout the world by Jews. So, you know, I had been grown up thinking that the Catholic Church held Jews and Judaism in contempt, and this really showed me that in some fundamental sense, the opposite is true. And that is going to be really the theme of what I talk about tomorrow. But there's one other thing I want to talk about that happened when I was at the Carthusian Monastery, which was these monks have a very penitential life, you know, terrible food and only once a day and so little of it, as Woody Allen says. Very dry life. And I would have thought that they would have been sour and embittered and unhappy old men. And instead, they ran around like kindergartners, you know, sharing a secret. And there was this tremendous loving warmth and actually womanly presence that permeated the monastery. And I understood without being told that that womanly presence that permeated the monastery and in fact permeates the Catholic Church is the spirit of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And there's a very real way, and I can't explain this theologically, where the Catholic Church is kind of, I don't want to say it's the body of the Blessed Virgin Mary, I know it's the body of Christ, but that it's an external form and the internal fire, womanly warmth permeating and enlivening the Catholic Church is the presence of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And that's what made all of these monks, you know, feel so loved and be so peaceful and be so happy inside, was their union with the Blessed Virgin Mary. So once I saw the unity between the Virgin Mary and the Catholic Church, and already had a love and fidelity to the Virgin Mary, that kind of transferred itself over into, you know, understanding the true spirit of the Catholic Church, which is, to a great extent, the spirit of the Blessed Virgin Mary. So let me see. Okay, I'll end with just saying, that'll leave a little time for at least a couple of questions and answers. I will just say one thing, which is when I did come into the Catholic Church, I was always a little bit surprised when cradle Catholics would come up to me and like throw open their arms and say, "Welcome to our church." Because I couldn't help thinking if the Catholic faith is true, it should be me throwing open my arms and saying to them, "Welcome to my church." Because the Catholic Church is nothing but the continuation of Judaism after the coming of the Jewish Messiah. That as a Catholic, there isn't a single Jewish belief that I was told to give up or had to give up, right? The entire Jewish sacred scriptures are accepted as divine revelation by the Catholic Church, right? The Old Testament. There wasn't any Jewish belief that I was told to give up other than the Jewish belief, which isn't really a theological belief, which is around who was Jesus. So, I don't mind when people call me a convert and say I used to be Jewish and I'm Catholic now, but I don't feel that way. I feel more Jewish than ever, right? I feel like I'm a Jew in the Catholic Church, because if I was a Jew if I was a Jew when I was wrong about who Jesus was, and Jesus was in fact the Jewish Messiah, how come I became less Jewish by going from being a Jew who is wrong about the Jewish Messiah to a Jew who is right about the Jewish Messiah? That should make me more Jewish, not less Jewish, especially if Jews are supposed to be right about everything, right? So, the church is made up of Jew and Gentile. There isn't the fundamental distinction that there was before the coming of Jesus, because there was a way that salvation was open to Jews in a different way than it was open to Gentiles, to non-Jews, before the coming of Jesus. And Jesus broke down those barriers and opened up the fullness of salvation to the whole world, to Gentiles as well. So that distinction, which is the distinction that actually Paul references in Galatians, that's gone. I mean, Gentiles have just as much right, needless to say, to salvation and to heaven as Jews do. But they're still, they're still, in another sense, they're still, I wasn't planning to talk about this, but some meaningfulness to Jewish identity in this period between the first and second coming of Christ. And in fact, that is going to be the overarching theme of tomorrow's talk, which is basically the role of Judaism in the second coming. And I'll just give a little teaser now, and most of you will be at tomorrow's talk, so you'll forgive me when you hear this again tomorrow. Paragraph 674 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church says, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." So Catholic dogma, the second coming can't happen until there's a widespread, if you excuse the pun, wholesale conversion of the Jews. Okay? So the conversion of the Jews is a necessary, almost last step to bring about the second coming. And that's not speculation, that's actually dogma. And it's based in a number of places in Scripture, which I'll talk about tomorrow. And it's repeated and crystallized in paragraph 674 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I actually think that the conversion of the Jews, which is going on now, Messianic Judaism, Jews for Jesus, all of that stuff, is a sign of the times and is the beginning of this wave of Jewish entry into the church, which is going to prepare the way for the second coming, which is the way in which I interpret that dream I had, which is why I mentioned that dream. So I think it is. So anyway, I do have actually about 5 or 10 minutes for questions. So if anyone has any questions or comments, and I'll repeat you'll have to yell it for me to hear it, but then I'll repeat it so everyone else can hear it. Yes? Great questions. The first question is, are there groups of Jewish Catholics, and what are they called, and where are they, and so forth? And the second question is how does Jewish conversion now in numbers compare to earlier Jewish conversion? The first question is, yes, there are groups of Jewish Catholics. As to what they're called, that's a bit of a problem, because no two of us can agree on what we should call ourselves. So the organization of Jewish Catholics is actually called the Association of Hebrew Catholics. But I don't like that term, Hebrew Catholic, so I don't call myself a Hebrew Catholic. I think it should be called the Association of Jewish Catholics. But there's an old joke, two Jews, three opinions, and it's certainly borne out. There are a few. The Association of Hebrew Catholics, which has a website called HebrewCatholic.org, which, by the way, has the full approval of the Catholic Church. It was invited to St. Louis by Cardinal Archbishop Burke, who then became the highest legal authority in the Catholic Church when he was the head of the Signaturate in the Vatican. So he definitely is, 100% kosher in the Catholic point of view. There are a couple of other organizations, Remnant of Israel, which was founded by a Jew who became a Redemptorist priest, Arthur Kleiber. He passed away recently. But Association of Hebrew Catholics is kind of like the most official and the largest. And nobody knows the numbers of Jewish Catholics, of Jews in the Catholic Church. In the United States, it's probably somewhere between 30,000 and 100,000. It's hard to tell. The other part of that question, is there more Jewish conversion going on now than in the past? The answer is yes. And the sign of that is the Messianic Jewish movement, which only began in the late 1960s. In 1967, there were only about two or three Messianic Jewish congregations. Messianic Jews is just a blanket term, an umbrella term, for Jews who realized that Jesus was the Jewish Messiah. And after that, everything's up for grabs, whether they consider themselves Christians, whether they consider themselves Protestants, a few are in the Catholic Church, and so forth. But anyway, in 1967, there were two or three Messianic Jewish congregations in the United States, and 200 or 300 Messianic Jews. Today, there are about 250 Messianic Jewish congregations in the United States and somewhere between 200 and 300,000 Messianic Jews, which compares to about 500,000 Orthodox Jews. So there's about one Jewish believer in the Messiah, in Jesus, for every two Orthodox Jews in the United States. Israel doesn't have a city or town without a Messianic Jewish congregation. And this was unheard of before 1970. Worldwide, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I think it's somewhere around 500,000-600,000 Messianic Jews. And I think that's a sign of this movement, and it's definitely higher than historical rates of conversion. I find it sad that most of them don't find their way into the Catholic Church, but I put the responsibility of that to a large extent on, I don't want to sound Catholics, that's not nice, but you know, Southern Baptists are out evangelizing Jews, evangelicals are out evangelizing Jews. God forbid a Catholic should suggest to a Jew that Jesus was actually Jewish, you know, and they might want to look into it. You know, there's such a shyness about triumphalism, about, you know, we don't want to rub your face in it. You know, of course, the Jewish response will always be, after the Holocaust, how dare you, as though bringing Jews into the fullness of salvation that they brought the rest of the world is comparable to exterminating them, right? I mean, it's like the most ridiculous thing in the world. But of course, that's their response is going to be. And the Catholic world has largely been intimidated away from evangelizing Jews as a result. And that's one reason I do what I do, because nobody can call me anti-Semitic because I'm Jewish. So, you know, if a cradle Catholic was up there saying, why don't you pray for the conversion of the Jews? Why don't you evangelize in a nice way your Jewish friends and neighbors? They'd be accused of being an anti-Semite, but they have trouble accusing me of being an anti-Semite. But anyway, I know that there was no way I could possibly have been happy not being Catholic. I'll tell a little very personal story, which is many years after I entered the church, about 15 years after I entered the church, I got a phone call from my last girlfriend before my conversion, which means, you know, the wrong kind of girlfriend. It was a, you know, very contemporary relationship. And she calls me up after 15 years, and she wants to find out what happened to me. And so the first thing she says on the phone is, I was sure you would have killed yourself by now, would have committed suicide, which is true, because without my conversion, I would have, because there was no point to anything, and I was in such a black despair. And then I told her, no, you know, I had this experience, and now I'm a fervent Catholic. And her response was, I never would have thought you would have taken the easy way out. So, you know, committing suicide was the noble way out. And, you know, coming to intimacy with Jesus was taking the easy way out. So if you don't evangelize Jews, that's actually what you're doing to them. You know, you're putting them in column A instead of column B. You're putting them in the column of, you guys have seen a Woody Allen movie, you know Woody Allen? You know, because people say to me, you know, maybe it's just you who, you know, couldn't be happy before you became Christian. My response is, go see a Woody Allen movie. Because what's behind his humor and what's behind even now his drama is the despair and pointlessness of life, right? It's a black humor, and it's the state that anyone who doesn't have Jesus and doesn't know about God are forced to be in. And you're depriving people of that if you don't evangelize them. And finally, as my final intimidation to evangelize, we are all going to die someday. We're all going to have a particular judgment. We're all going to be in front of Jesus and reviewing our life in the presence of Jesus and seeing all of the events of our life. And one of those events, God forbid, is going to be the following, which is, you know, you got on an airplane, You were sitting next to somebody, you started saying your rosary, you were embarrassed, you hid your rosary under your jacket so they wouldn't see what you were doing, right? And Jesus is going to point out that situation to you and is going to say, do you see that? Do you remember when you were sitting next to them? I sent you to them. You were their one chance to come to know me, and you were afraid of being embarrassed. And as a result, they never came to know me. Okay, our lives are going to be filled with those things. If you went to Mass this morning, the reading was Herod and the beheading of John the Baptist. Did any of you go to Mass and hear that hearing? Reading, why did Herod behead John the Baptist? Fear of human respect, right? He had made that promise in front of all of his friends and the other, you know, big shots, and he didn't want to go back on his promise. It was fear of human respect that caused him to behead John the Baptist. Fear of human respect is the devil's like number one tool at stopping evangelization, of stopping our spread of the gospel. You know, if you want to be thought well of and respected by, you know, your colleagues on the Harvard faculty or the MIT faculty or where you work, you better not let them, you better not wear your religion on your sleeve, you better not let them know you believe in everything the Catholic Church teaches and so forth. But all of that human respect isn't going to amount to anything in 60 years to us. And everything we do that, you know, brings somebody else, just plants a seed that makes them think about the possibility that God might be real or Jesus might be real or the sacraments of the Catholic Church might be real, we're going to be rewarded to for all eternity. So take that as advice from Harvard Business School marketing professor, okay? That's where the real return on your investment is. So last question, I think, and then I should tie up, yeah? It's a good question. The question was, when I mentioned the experience with Our Lady, I mentioned that ecstasy, and was that a spiritual ecstasy? I'm tempted to say, what other kind of ecstasy is there? I don't know what a physical ecstasy would be in the sense that, you know, I wasn't jumping up and down, but it was just, you know, pure, distilled joy and happiness and love, you know, that, you know, one would think the human soul could not contain. So I guess that is kind of a spiritual ecstasy. And I'll end there. That's what's awaiting all of us if we play our cards right. And that's what everyone else out there is depriving themselves of. And I went on Friday night, or Thursday night, I arrived here. I went to dinner at a pub in town, which I really, really liked the beer of, what's it called? Phantom Brewery. And I was looking around at all the 20-somethings, you know, they're on their dates or they're having a good time at the pub. And they were healthy, you know, and they were yuppies and they were maybe in their early 20s, you know, kind of bursting with physical life. And there was such sadness and such despair on all of their faces. And, you know, that's where we would be without the gift of faith. And that's what we're condemning everyone else to when we don't wear our religion on our sleeves. And it doesn't have to be, don't tell them they should be anything else than they are, but just let them know where your joy and where your peace come from. And that will, as St. Paul says, you know, that will make them jealous. That will make them want to look into it. So with that, thank you very much, and I'll be back tomorrow. Wait a minute, just to give honor to my Jewish background, I do have a book table out there. I do have books and CDs and tapes and so forth to peddle. I have prayer cards for the conversion of the Jews, which are free because I'm at least half converted and so forth. So I'll be out there.
Wonderful, wonderful story and witness. Thank you very much, Roy. And Roy will be on again at 9:00 in the morning.